Next case on our calendar is 001572, James P. Wallace, Senior Administrator versus Dennis J. Ballant. We're very, Justice Sweeney has recused himself from this case. We're very pleased to have sitting in place of Justice Sweeney, Judge Robert Gorman, who's a judge of the Court of Appeals sitting in the First District. Welcome, Judge Gorman.
Thank you, Justice.
Mr. Eiler.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. There's two points I wish to address in the 15 minutes allotted to me. One is the ambiguity in the anti-stacking provision, and the other is the violation of contract law as it applies to Christina and to Christopher, the son and the brother and sister of the decedent. Contract law has been violated in that point quite clearly. Insofar as the ambiguity is concerned, it looks as though the insured must take the provisions of the main policy and shuffle between the main policy and the endorsement. Not only must he be able to understand what the main policy is, he has to look at the endorsement. Then he has to look to see how the main policy provisions are changed by the endorsement. Then he has to determine how the endorsement language fits into the contract of insurance. Then he has to analyze and say, what do I have in the main policy? What do I have in the endorsement? Is it clear to me? We know from the main portions of the policy the stacking has not been defined. Stacking is not used in the main portion of the policies that are involved. But we do have a situation where it's been amended, and in the endorsement they say stacking is prohibited. Why was that done? Why did you have to define and you have to say stacking is prohibited in the endorsement if you're saying in the main case it was quite clear? See, it wasn't clear to the underwriters. It wasn't clear to the insurance adjusters. It's not clear to lawyers. It's not clear to judges. It's not clear to the insureds. So the question then arises, well, who should make this assent? How is a customer and insured supposed to buy something? We say, well, with full knowledge of what you're buying, like your house, or like your car, or like your insurance policy. But we don't have that. We have an ambiguity that's been demonstrated with the endorsement itself. Why did State Farm have to put a definition in it by saying it's not even a definition, but under that section it says stacking is prohibited. Well, if you already had it in the main section and it was understood by Christina Wallace and James Wallace and Wanda, let's take an example. My question is my client Wanda Wallace. A non-college educated person, high school, maybe has to look at this and determine what does the main provision of the policy mean? What am I buying? So we say, well, what you're buying is an anti-stacking provision. And so case after case has come before the Supreme Court to judges and lawyers to try to define what does this all mean. And yet we expect that the Wallaces knew that. That's why the reasonable expectation test should apply here. And that takes care of the extrinsic evidence rule. And it's a meaningful point to me when you have something. We're asked to interpret our own medical records. I can read I have a blood test, and I have to determine what does the blood test mean in the light of low electrolytes. Is this what we asked the Wallaces to do? And the answer is yes, that's what we want them to do. This court unanimously agreed on the Dews test and the Dews principles. And that's what an issue here. Shuffling back and forth, that's what the law requires here, shuffling back and forth between the main provisions of the policy by Wanda and James Wallace, Chris the son, and Katrina. They have to go through their policies and look back and forth, make these comparisons, make the analyzation, and finally say, aha, the light went on, I think I understand it, these non-lawyers, non-judges, not underwriters. And so an opportunity presents itself here. We've talked about this before, about reasonable expectancies.
Are you arguing that the endorsement should not be given effect? Because I think the endorsement helps you.
Well, if the endorsement helps me, the only I see the way the endorsement helps me insofar as anti-stacking is concerned, that it now uses the word that it did not use in the main principle, in the main portion of the policy, stacking.
And insured.
And insured. Who the insureds are.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's crucial. But the point is we're into a situation now on the ambiguity part where either we're gonna hold to dues and say these eight policies require the dues attention. The Court of Appeals didn't do that, to my view. Now, the Court of Appeals brought in its main proposition that an insurance carrier can amend the policy. We agree with that. Court of Appeals said that. But I see nothing in a Court of Appeals opinion about an analysis that was made under dues. I see no dues test there. I see no analyzation of the dues test. I see the proposition that I think we all agree with, that you can amend a policy. Of course you can amend a policy. And that's all the Court of Appeals said, without any further analyzation. So what drove the Court of Appeals then to say, well, you can collect on one policy, you know, up to the per occurrence limits of $100,000? How do we get to that?
Error.
Well, you know, to my way of thinking, I'm saying if the court would have taken the time to apply the deuce test of ambiguity, clarity, and insofar as conspicuous is concerned, take the word conspicuous. Now, what do we expect that Wanda and James and Katrina and Christopher, what are they looking for? Something conspicuous, like a red tag, like a big thing that says, we change your policy. We change your policy. Please understand this. Call your agent. Ask him about these changes before you buy eight policies. Is that too much to ask? If you have any questions, call. No, that wasn't done at all. So we put the shuffling back and forth between provisions and words, which are legal words. We know, don't we? And I'm sure we do. We know why those changes came in. They weren't done for the benefit of the insured. They were done in anticipation of litigation. They were done because this court, time after time after time, has defined what the uninsured motorist statute is. Those changes came in not to help an insured understand his policy, but to protect State Farm against the lawsuits that came when you're asking for per occurrence limits for everybody.
You going to move to the contract issue?
Say again, I will. In the policy and in the briefs that ran, they say that all these eight people are collectively, they're collectively bound, instead of having a separate contract issue. There was a special contract between Katrina and her insurance company that was not involved in her father's insurance policy or her mother's insurance.
Is that so? Does Christopher and Katrina each have separate policies?
Separate policies.
Their own names. And James and Wanda's policies are on their names.
True.
And the decedent's policies were in his name.
Exactly, Your Honor.
Fine.
So now what we say, we
bunch... That's not stacking, is it?
Pardon me?
Then that's not stacking, is it?
I don't know. You're bunching them all together. It's not stacking. It can't be stacking. So what we, but what the defense is saying, we're putting them all together under, quote, a household. I'm saying, what household? The household didn't pay a premium. What's a household? Is it defined as such? Katrina's policy paid her own premium for that. That's her contract. Why should she be binded by a non-party? She's a non-party to her father's contract. Chris is the same way. Why is he bound by his father's contract? What do you mean we're going to treat these people collectively? What happened to contract law? What happened to contract law? These people are separate, separate individuals, separate contracts, but State Farm lumps them together and says, you know what? You better talk to your mom and your dad. And the agent says, why don't you go to Progressive and Allstate? See, if you went to Progressive and Allstate, then you wouldn't have we wouldn't get into this problem, see? But no, I'll take your premiums on eight policies, and then when you come to collect on your death of your brother, I'll tell you you're all together, you're all bunched up together. We violate contract law by saying non-parties are bound by somebody else's contracts. How do we do that? I think maybe that can be explained in only one way. It violates. And that's the idea to me that there's a contract violation here in this case. I think also what I'm doing here and what Mr. Henteman's doing here is impossible for us to do. And it was impossible for Wanda and James to do. How could they possibly stand before and make this kind of an argument to anybody, to themselves, to their sons, to their daughters, and say, look, I read the policy. You know, we have to have bodily injury. You know, can you imagine that conversation at the dinner table when they're saying what to each other? How did he analyze this? Well, let's see. What's stacking? There's no stacking. Well, let's find out what's stacking. Call the insurance adjuster and ask him what stacking is. Does that mean we can't collect? How come we're paying a premium? How come we don't get a reduction in the premium when you lump us all together? But you take the money, sure enough, except when I have a claim for the death of my brother and my son. That's why the doctrine of reasonable expectancy should be considered seriously here. Because there are some areas where it is impossible for an insured to understand what the provisions of the policy are. They can't do it. But if you would have told the Wallaces, under a stacking provision, your policy will be ineffective, would they have still bought the policy? Or would they have gone somewhere else so you can get a diversity of owners, it goes down to Progressive, to Allstate, whoever you want? Well, 39 states have talked about the reasonable expectancy, and we talked about it before, as you know, and I think, as we mentioned before, it's a great mission of the law. The great mission of the law is to fulfill reasonable expectancies. That's what we're about. That's what the law is about. We are not some ethereal group of people who have an education, who are judges, and who are lawyers. We are not. There's something more to the law, and it's our duty, it's our responsibility to protect people against. What if you don't have an education and you can't read fine print? What if you have a fourth grade education and you can't read? And most people that can't read are embarrassed to say they can't read and can't understand. I mean, it is just, to me, ridiculous for State Farm to take a position.
Are any of these people in this case illiterate?
No, Judge. But none of these people are beyond high school education.
Well, what if you can read and still can't understand?
Well, that's why I'm here. That's what I mentioned earlier. Mr. Henteman will get up now and he'll give his opinion. And case after case that we've had, the Moore case, all the cases that have come before you, this mad, sad, glad parade of people coming here to understand what the law is. So I still read. Does that mean because I can read, I understand what per person limits are and what the highest is? No, every conceivable way has been manufactured by State Farm to get away from paying. That's the bottom line. To get away, to raise a legal defense in the policy so that when Mr. Henteman and I come here on a dispute or anybody else from State Farm can be protected. And that's what this is about, to my view. I think that one of the main issues that you have in the case, that I see in this case, Your Honors, is that the analyzation of these provisions by a layperson is next to impossible. It is impossible for Wanda and for James and the others to look at this policy language and try to figure out what it means. And incidentally, you don't figure out that means at an arm's length at a table. The policy is sent to you after you get the premium. You have no way to contribute to the language. You have no way to amend the language. You have no way to dispute the language. State Farm says take it or leave it. In effect, that's what happens. But you don't participate in a contract of law. The insurance agent calls you, says, once we get your premium, you're covered. So it's 3 months later, you get a policy. You take the policy and put it in a drawer. And does anybody do anything other than that? I think the affidavits are an issue, to my view. Never have affidavits been so disregarded. Somebody's sworn testimony comes in the form of an affidavit. There's 30, and insofar as Civil Rule 36 is concerned, there are six occasions under Rule 36 where affidavits are mentioned as a means of making an issue of genuine fact. There are six times in Civil Rule 32, the 36, where that applies. Well, why is it there? Why are we saying if the summary judgment's been filed against you and you don't respond by affidavit or otherwise, or that you're out? All of a sudden I have affidavits here which are uncontested. See, State Farm could have brought their underwriter down here and said, wait a minute. They could have brought the insurance agent down here and said, I did explain. So what happened to the uncontested affidavits are totally disregarded. They were disregarded by the trial court. Disregarded by the Court of Appeals. People said I didn't understand what they're talking about. I don't know what underinsured is means. It's kind of interesting, too, if I may just take a sideline from here. So in the brief of State Farm, they say, well, you know, we have intra-family stacking and inter-family stacking, and then we know that when 3927 was amended, they say we did this alleged because of Savoy. So Savoy has been superseded by SB 20. Everybody knows that. But in the briefs, they say, now he goes back and says in his brief, well, now we have intra-family. Oh, I say, wait a minute. If the legislature nullified and superseded Savoy, now you're coming in to say, well, there's intra-family stacking. I'm saying, when does this stop? When does manufacturing of provisions end? And this court should end it.
Your reasonable expectations doctrine. On page 22 of your brief, you sum it up by saying we should adopt the reasonable doctrine, remove the illusionary belief in the plaintiffs, insurers in this case. What specifically are you referring to? The stacking?
Yes.
Provision?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor. I'm
the
saying
contract
that.
Contract provision wouldn't be the reasonable expectations doctrine.
No.
That's pretty clear between the two parties.
Yes.
So you're just applying it to the stacking.
To the stacking, yeah.
Isn't stacking part of the contract, though?
Well,
it's in
that,
there. The provision is in there that says exactly what's going to happen.
With
it's in words.
Yes, Judge.
Really hard to understand words, but they're there.
Well, I understand, Judge. See, this is the, if, with deepest respect, Your Honor, this is what the Court of Appeals said. Without examination, we say, but it's there. You're condemned by it. It's there. Can't you read it? It's right in the policy. It says there. It's prohibited. I'm saying the fact is that when Wanda has to look at that and say, what that means is I'm precluded. So why should I buy four policies? Why should I buy four policies with State Farm when I know I can only collect on one?
On this one scenario where one person was injured, that's the scenario that triggers it. Otherwise, there's a lot of good reasons to have the policy. Many, many other scenarios that each person needs to have a policy. Their own liability, for instance, the uninsured motorist if it's more than one person. I mean, you know, we all know there. This scenario, you want to say it was not a good buy, and reasonable people could disagree with even that. But it's in the language is in each person's policy, isn't it?
Do we think that the Wallaces understood that?
I don't know that the law has ever, in the law of contracts, and we'd say this is the law of contracts has ever made the judgment based on a subjective judgment. We take, you know, we check the IQ of each individual contractor for their mortgage, their car payment. I mean, we don't do that. The law doesn't take that into consideration. Now, if we go to unconscionable, you know, or something that's fraudulent,
right.
the law acknowledges those exceptions.
Right. Well, then what happened to the principles of offer, acceptance, consideration? Where are those then? See, that's my point, Judge. I'm saying, okay, you can put what you want in a contract, but then what happens to contract law? Then what happens to offer, acceptance, consideration, etc.? Where's the meeting of the minds? We can say, well, forget the meeting of the minds. We don't need to have that because the court will tell you what's ambiguous and what's not. Why do we have to bring in? So what happens now under the interpretation of State Farm is we'll tell you what you should know and we'll tell you what you don't have to understand. And if that's where the court if that's where the law has reached to a position where we have withdrawn the consumer, the insured, from consideration in the policy, you can sell him anything, whether he understands it or he doesn't understand it. I have a hard time believing, Your Honors, that if Wanda was told and if Jimmy were told that under the terms of anti-stacking in his endorsement, he could not recover, I think he would have picked up the phone and called some other carriers and say, what about that? Why am I paying this premium? Why am I paying these premiums when I can't get to it?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Eiler.
Thank you, Judge.
Mr. Hinteman.
If it pleases the court, Mr. Eiler, my name is Henry Hinteman. I'm with the firm of Davis & Young, and I represent the Appley Cross Appellant in this particular case. I would like to start off by stating that though it's been like pulling teeth for over the many years, the legislature has clearly come out with an intent, an obvious intent, to limit UM coverage so that it is more affordable and available to more citizens of the state rather than giving gratuitous payments to other people. And I think the standard that this court also recognizes is that it wants to put the insureds in the same position as if they had been injured by an uninsured motorist. The underpinnings of this scheme for the uninsured motorist coverage statute of Ohio has been the anti-stacking clause and the set-off provision, plus others, the aggregate rather the personal limits rather than the aggregate limits availability. Mr. Eiler screams and hollers about the fact that it's ambiguous and how can the person compare one section of a policy with another section of the policy, and that judges and attorneys and underwriters don't understand the policy themselves, when I can say I know one group of people that do understand this policy, and that is this court. In Dews versus Hodge, this court unanimously held that the anti-stacking clause in the State Farm policy, in an endorsement attached to the policy, was clear, unambiguous, and was conspicuously placed in the policy. And now they want to revisit that because they want to tear it down so they can get more coverage. It is a fair scheme that the legislature is trying to accomplish, and it's, and the clauses are necessary to accomplish that. The fact that there are some changes in the endorsement are put in there because of the fact of this court's decision in the Savoy case, which ultimately led to the Senate Bill 20 situation. And the Senate Bill 20 situation tried to eliminate the exception that this court carved out with respect to interfamily stacking of interfamily policies versus stacking of intrafamily policies. And then when Senate Bill 20 came out, they had to put the endorsement on the policy to clarify it, so to let the insured know what the law is today. And when you look at it, it really doesn't substantially change one bit the anti-stacking provision contained in the basic policy, other than the fact that all stacking is prohibited. And that's what the Senate Bill 20 said, and they were communicating that to their insureds. Mr. Eiler gets carried away with respect to that the insured wasn't explained. Can you see the chaos in this state if an agent has to explain every exception in every policy before the policy would be valid and enforceable? In his brief, although he doesn't bring it up here, he refers to the 80 decision because Justice Celebrezze in 80 made the comment to the effect that, well, the agent exclusions have to be explained and the insured has to understand the exclusions before they're valid and enforceable. 80 was a plurality decision, and there's not one word about explaining the policy to the insured in the syllabus. In a plurality decision, the only law of that case is the syllabus.
Counsel, isn't that a problem for all of us? And I don't know that what Mr. Eiler advocates is a good course, but I was struck by your question. Can you see the confusion if every agent had to explain every provision of every insurance policy? We wouldn't have any insurance, would we? I don't know any agent in my town that could even come close.
Everybody would have a different interpretation, or many of them would.
But I don't think we're going to answer that issue here today, but isn't that a problem that we all ought to be struggling to make life better for all of our citizens on? Because, it is an important product in all of our lives, and the reality is even the people selling it to us can't explain it. And maybe as a court and as lawyers, we're all at fault there. But it's a problem for us.
And the obligation the insurer has is to put it in clear and unambiguous terms. And I maintain that the policy before this court involved in this case is clear and unambiguous, and the terms that pertain to the issues involved were conspicuously placed. There's bold print across the top that this endorsement applies to the basic policy. It's bold print as to the anti-stacking provision, which says if there's other insurance involved, here's what you're going to have to be faced with. And they try to lay it out, and they do lay it out in clear and uncertain terms, and this court said so in Dues versus Hodge. They said the fact that when you have multiple policies, you only use the policy with the highest limit, and they said that clearly conveys the intent that you can't stack. And this court said that in Dues versus Hodge. I'd like to just finish up with the 80 decision. There was, following 80, there was Hedrick, and the Hedrick decision disbanded the idea that you have to explain to the insured as to what the policies are. The risk that the insurance company runs is that they issue a policy or write a policy that's not clear and not unambiguous, and clarity and lack of ambiguity is a chore they have to do, and if it's clear and unambiguous, this court should not strain it or stress it to make it ambiguous, which is what Mr. Eiler wants this court to do. Getting to the cross appeal that the defendant has is that the court, if you read the appellate court's decision, it really doesn't make sense as to how it comes to the conclusion that the aggregate limits are available under this loss for the death of the plaintiff's decedent. They rely upon Moore. The Moore case that this court decided shortly, I think, after the trial court, but before the Court of Appeals decision, the Moore case deals with who is an insured under the policy, who is entitled to the benefits under the policy, not how much is available. And this case deals with how much coverage is available. And we submit that this court has upheld in Clark just recently, and this court has held that 393718H is valid and enforceable, and the limiting of all damages arising out of the death to one person is valid and enforceable under 3937H.
Do you like that Clark decision?
That was one of the better ones.
Funny, I never heard from you people about what a great decision it was.
It's a lot of fun. And it keeps us all busy. But the point is that in Clark, this court has held that by aggregating or avoiding the aggregation and limiting it to the one person was valid and enforceable.
But doesn't Moore apply to this extent that, in fact, these are wrongful death claims? So therefore, 2125 presumes damage and injury, regardless of whether there was a particular injury to the insured.
That's true. The Court of Appeals even stated that, the defendant, State Farm, relies upon the fact that the decedent was not an insured because he did not sustain the bodily injury. That's not true. We never argued that in the trial court. And I don't know where they came up with that. And also, in this case, we've never argued that the decedent was not an insured or that the mother was not an insured. Everybody in this case is an insured under all the policies involved. There's no question on coverage. There's no question as to who's insured, and therefore Moore has no application. And how it arrived at, how the court arrived at that decision is beyond my belief or beyond my comprehension.
You're arguing the cross appeal now?
The cross appeal, yes,
yeah.
With respect to that, because the Moore case, and the court solely relies upon Moore, and I don't believe Moore really has any application to that issue.
May I just spend a couple of minutes and take you through the way I see this case, and then tell me why I'm wrong if I am. Clearly, the tortfeasor had $25,000.
That's correct.
That $25,000 was paid to the estate?
It was paid to the administrator of the estate.
Claim was made against the decedent's first policy. It was set off against the $50,000. The decedent got an extra $25,000 for a total of $50,000. $25,000 from tortfeasor, $25,000 from his own policy, total $50,000. Then the second question is, the second policy of the decedent. Now, if you're trying to access the second policy, wouldn't that be stacking?
Yes, it would be.
Okay, and we know stacking can't stack. Now let's go to the mother and father. They have four separate policies. All individual policies in their names, not in the decedent's name.
But the decedent isn't insured under their policy.
But it's their policy, their original policy. Why can't they not access their first policy? Because, and then if you try to access the other three policies, that would be stacking to them. Isn't stacking, and doesn't your policy say to an insured? And the insured in this case that we start with is the decedent. The second insured are the parents, separate and apart from the decedent. And then go to the third step, a separate policy for Christina and whatever his name was. Those are separate policies in their names, and they ought to be able to access them up to the amount of the damages they could prove for the wrongful death. If you try to stack those, if you try to use those for the insurance, that is the original insurer, the decedent, wouldn't that be stacking? And in this case, are these not, is not stacking unless you take the second policy of the decedent and try to add to the first, the three policies of the parents, and try to add it to their first policy. Wouldn't that be stacking, and this is not stacking if you do it that way?
Before you answer that, would you diagram that question?
I think I understand. I think that you're trying to say you start off with the first policy, but what I think you have to understand also is the fact that the decedent, the mother, the father, the sister, the brother were all insured under all policies.
Sure.
Definition
only
number
because
five.
Because they live in the same household.
Because they live in the same household.
Okay.
That's
but,
right.
But you're
and
not trying to stack their policies.
But,
that
it, the point is that the way it works, and I shouldn't say this because I don't have testimony to this effect, but it says in this policy that then they will be you take the policy with the highest limit, and that will be the policy available, and it'll be available on a pro rata basis with respect to all other policies. There are cases, I do know, I don't know whether it happened in this case, but then they prorate them among all the policies. The payment made is prorated among all the policies, because it's a pro rata clause after you get the highest policy limit. And what I'm saying here is that to get back to the purpose of all of this is that is to put them in the same position that they would be in if they had uninsured motorist coverage. And I think that flows throughout the Luttrell decision. And if they put in the same position as an uninsured motorist, if the tortfeasor in this case were an uninsured motorist, and if and the anti-stacking laws are on the books, the single limits clauses are on the books, then they would still only get $50,000.
No, because 3937.18A2 talks about amount available for payment.
So there
A2
deals with underinsured motorists. I'm trying to compare it with an uninsured motorist, which is the criteria the Luttrell case says we must use. Mm-hmm. And if they're uninsured, then you've got A1. And A1 is an uninsured motorist, and therefore you don't have the point I was trying to make. I lost there for a minute.
You don't have the amount available for payment.
That's right. You still have the $50,000 would be available to the administrator of the estate who got the $50,000 under our scenario in $25,000 increments. And so I maintain that the court should. We didn't touch on their claim that the liability limits should be expanded, but I think that's been a given. I don't think that we only have to pay the per person limit for the liability coverage. We request that the court affirm the Court of Appeals with respect to the stacking, anti-stacking provisions, et cetera, and reverse and enter judgment for the defendant with respect to the cross appeal.
Thank you, Mr. Hedeman. Mr. Eiler, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Thank you very much, Judge, Your Honor. The legislature did not intend to supersede the Sexton case, so the Sexton case is alive, and well, its application here, I think, is apparent. And I think that's kind of important. Insofar as the question that was raised about how much should the insurance adjuster divulge, should he do the same as a lawyer should do? Should he
on an important matter, should he do what the lawyer does, sit with the client, explain the cause of action, same the ups and downs of a case? Should he do what a doctor does and say, this is what I think we should do, we should do some testing for you, blood work, so forth? Should he do anything? Here they write the language themselves. They have trained insurance agents who come in and tell you what they think you need. And is it too much to say, I'm going to explain the exclusions to you. I'm going to tell you what your policy does not do. Is that asking too much from trained State Farm people or Allstate people or anybody? And why isn't the language, when it becomes ambiguous, construed against them? I don't think we're asking too much for the insurance agent to do that, at least to explain exclusions just as well as coverages. They do explain as much as they want to explain to make the sale. We're talking about a sale here, a buyer and a seller. And that's what we have here, and I think that there should be some attention given to that, and thanks very much to the court for taking the case and listening to us.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. The marshal, please adjourn court.
All rise.